Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the China Startup Pulse. I'm Ryan Shukin here with Todd Embley. How's it going, Todd?
It's going very well. Thank you, Ryan.
That is very polite. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
There you go. That's nice.
I'm an upstanding, polite citizen.
You're Canadian, so you're actually extra polite. On your worst days, you're actually very, very polite.
I'm sorry.
And today we have T.R. Harrington here.
Yes, and good friend, longtime mentor at China Accelerator.
Yep, yeah. And he's one of those rare cases where it's a foreigner, started a company here in China, mm-hmm. and exited successfully.
Has recently.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a long road, and mm-hmm. he's been through a lot.
Yes.
You know, and we said at the very end of the episode, this is like a podcast version of The Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Yeah.
It is uncanny how many similarities there are mm-hmm. in his 10 years here.
Wow.
Longer than 10 years. I mm-hmm. mean, going through the whole, you know, the how to start up a digital media and advertising company here in China. He's a foreigner. And then we go mm-hmm. through the co-founder conundrum, as we were calling it.
Yeah, the co-founder.
And all the things that he's done and how he's had to pivot the businesses due to changes in kind of the macroeconomic environment. Mm-hmm. And then the changing landscape of media and internet, you know, in China and abroad and all these kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, imagine starting, like he said, a digital marketing and advertising company when Baidu and Alibaba were just beginning too.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the
just
heyday of
out,
everything starting.
Yeah, and a massive pivot due to the fact that from Alibaba, yeah. which he explains, and so we won't do it here.
But he also talks about the hidden co-founder, which I thought was really interesting.
The hidden co-founder as well, yes.
Yeah.
Very, very good point. And then, of course, you know, the exit, and he talks a little bit about that. It's an amazing story. It's an amazing ride. It's something very few foreigners have had the opportunity to do mm-hmm. here in China. So without further ado,
yeah.
shall we?
Let's get into it.
Let's do it. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the China Startup Pulse. And I am Todd, as you know, and I'm here with you know who's going to do his thing at the beginning of every episode,
yeah.
does the whole background. We're going to give the shady background of TR. I'm just kidding. I just said that because he's in front of me. All right, Ryan.
Yeah.
Do it.
So T.R. Harrington, he started, actually, his first trip to China was in 1994 as a tourist. And he ended up coming back a lot, but he actually had a lot of experience in startups and entrepreneurship in San Francisco in 1995 mm-hmm. with companies like Red Gorilla, Iconic Interactive, and Cybernautics, which are really cool company names that
yeah.
got bought into US Web later on.
Nice names.
Yeah. He actually ended up going back to China in 2001 mm-hmm. and then went to business school after that. But in 2004, he was in China for good. He started trying to figure out what he wanted to do, what he wanted to build. And by 2005, he started Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
Darwin is the full service digital internet startup that he has successfully got funding for and grown into one of the number one digital internet providers for services in China.
And most recently,
he got acquired.
Yes,
by
Exit.
Exit by iProspect.
So we're definitely going to be talking a little bit about that process because we don't get a lot of people who actually know what that's like in China. So we get to talk some exit strategy stuff here on today's show. So that's awesome. TR, welcome.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Thanks
for being here.
Now, I want to start with one of these stories that I happen to know already. You met your wife here in China. And this is a pretty funny story. I know it is. So quick recap on how this went down because there's like a lost phone and some things involved.
So yeah, so this is a big reason that I came back in 2004 right after graduation rather than staying and making some money and mm-hmm. saving something and yeah. pay down the debt, you know.
Yeah.
I came with $3,000 in the pocket for her.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the story goes, I'd been to China many, many times and I was coming over here for exchange on my MBA and I met her in a bar and I just thought she was this amazing smile, happy person, mm-hmm. and in a way that was very unusual to my experience in Shanghai. And so naturally, just started chatting her up. Eventually, I'm like, wow, it'd be great to see you again. Got to get the phone number. Big old rejection.
Ooh.
Right? And I'm like, man, did I misread the signs here? You know, I thought there was something, you know, happening. And it was just like, no. And so, you know, reignite, get back in the conversation. Rejection. Rejection, rejection, rejection. I spent 2 hours and I got rejected, I think, 7 or 8 times.
Wow.
And then
wow.
way out the door, she said, you know, because I don't give my phone number to strangers. She's like, you seem like a really good guy. I'm going to take a chance. And she gave me the phone number, one of those old Nokia you know, phones, right?
Nokia bricks.
Feature phone.
Yeah, exactly. And I went home that night, and I think I slept with the phone under the pillow. You know, like it was just like, yes, yes. And the next day, what did I do? I lost the phone.
No.
I did. I lost the phone on like, you know, like an MBA exchange student, John, out of town, coming back. And I was just completely beside myself, chasing, you know, the organizer, call the bus driver, do anything. Nobody can find it. And I went out that night and I just got Irish drunk.
Yeah.
Right? I got Irish drunk and, you know, Saturday, you know, so it happened Thursday. You know, this is Friday night. Saturday was just, you know, recovery day. And Sunday, I actually picked up the landline to call one of my exchange student friends. And I said, what's up? And he's like, dude, they found your phone. And I'm like, no. I'm like, dude, don't mess with me. That's not cool. I'm very vulnerable. And it was actually there. I've lost my phone in China subsequently to that, like around five or six other times. Yeah. It never came back.
No.
Maybe it was the fact that it was that old, you know, brick Nokia phone that nobody wanted. But at that time, that was actually a semi-decent phone. But yeah, it was purely kismet, fate, you know, to get that phone back. And after that, I saw my wife every night for the next 3 months. And 6 months later, I moved to China.
Wow.
Okay. Awesome story. Love it. Love it. Love it.
So what did you, what was the driving aspect? Did you learn a lot from being in San Francisco during the startup boom? And that's why you're saying like, okay, it's 2004. I'm going to, with my buddies, start something in China, which eventually led to Darwin. Or what was the catalyst there?
I think certainly I saw tons of craziness in San Francisco and then everything kind of popped. Right. And then there was like, no matter what kind of an idea you had, it wasn't going to get funded. It was just like, go run and hide in business school and go work at a big company and wait it out until everybody decides tech is not a pariah anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, there's no point in staying here because there's nothing going to happen. So I should at least try to find someplace else where things are happening. And that's why I moved to China that first time. But when I came in 2001, I mean, it was like Sina Sohu and NetEase were like perilously close to delisting because advertising market had just crashed here. But on the flip side, they found the wireless value-added service market, all these ringtones and text messages, voting, stuff like that, right? Yeah. You know, the Chao Jie Nusheng, the first voting.
Yeah, I remember the voting.
Right. You know, I knew the guys who founded that company. They made $30 million on voting. I'm like, there is something happening here.
Wow. Yeah.
And I figured this would be a great adventure. You know, it would be earlier stage. Some of the stuff I'd learned before I could use, but it was hard because the beginning part wasn't very data driven, wasn't very measurable. It was branding. And no matter how good my Chinese gets and it's still not good enough, I'm not going to outbrand a local.
No.
Just not. So more about when Jack Ma basically decided to line it all up and go after eBay, full stop. You had 100 million people. Right. You finally had a payment gateway, right? You had Alipay, and then you had this platform in Taobao. And once you start tracking all the way through to conversion, guess what? Data is language and cultural neutral. That's my in.
Yeah.
That was the way I found my way in.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I like that.
Yeah.
Because that speaks to all the opportunities here. I mean, if you can get to the heart of the data that's going on or the numbers or the, you can always make an impact and difference. You can use that to benefit. So what was the, when you did start Darwin, what did you guys first start with?
So we started with something we thought we could sell, right? Which was performance-based marketing from the West, which had been affiliate marketing, right? Which is pay for performance pure. Right. It's basically like Amazon says, okay, if you add a link to your blog and somebody clicks that link and they buy the book, I will give you 15%. But I'm only going to pay you after I get the sale. Now, in China, there's a huge problem. Outside the family, Chinese don't trust other Chinese let around Lao Wai like us. Right. Foreigners. So trying to sell them advertising is really, really hard because they're like, I want sales. So with affiliate, you're basically selling sales.
Yeah.
Right. And you're just collecting after the sale. That made at least getting the initial set of advertisers a lot easier. It wasn't purely MNCs. Like we had Dongdong, we had eBay, we had Taobao and stuff. But the problem was that Taobao got too big. They really? Literally just got too big too fast.
Because when you first started, they were pretty small. 2005.
Well, they didn't need to advertise.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like everything's pretty common. I remember 2004 in China. I mean, I can't believe that you saw all this opportunity there in all these ways, because 2004, when I first got here, it was a totally different landscape.
Absolutely. There wasn't an established search market. You know, Baidu was still a comer, a very early comer. And I keep thinking back, if I'd taken that same 100 grand US and I just bought Baidu stock, I'd be a lot richer today. But, you know, it's the journey, not the end, right? So, yeah. So we started out an affiliate. We built the platform. I called up because of my relationships in San Fran with an iconic. The guy who was now CTO of Linkshare in 2005, I just had a conversation. I'm like, yeah, I want to build this in China. Tell me all I need about the tech. He's like, it's not about the tech. It's all about publishers and advertisers and relationship managers. Like the tech, you can just take shrink wrapped, localize it, and build it out. So because of that, I knew exactly how to spec it out. And our first hire was a developer. And that was in March of 2005. So by June of 2005, we had our affiliate platform up and running. And then we just started aggressively acquiring publishers. And we got up to like, you know, some like 30,000 publishers within 6 months and doing like millions of impressions, you know, every single day and lots of different advertisers. But you, affiliate is really, it's a, they call it a two-sided marketplace and it needs to be balanced. Right? When you have Taobao getting to like 85% of all the B2C side, right? And the C2C side, it wasn't balanced. And because of that, Alibaba just set up their own. Right? They said, it's not, the technology's not difficult. So they said, here, you can go work with Darwin or with Ichifa or any of these other guys who were out there doing the affiliate space. Or you can just work directly with Alibaba. And we'll give you more.
You know, we'll make it even easier. Come on and walk on.
Yeah, exactly. Because Alibaba is basically like, well, I'm already giving away 15% to you guys, i.e., the third party guys who are standing in between. He's like, I'm going to give the affiliates instead of 85%, I'm going to give them 95%. I'm just going to take 5%. You know, which just basically overnight just kills the business model.
Oh, God.
It's over. Right. Again, we, you know, within 3 months of actually, by the time we'd even specced out and started on building the affiliate, I'd come back from my first search conference. And I'm like, I told my Chinese co-founder, I spent 6 months convincing that affiliate was the future. Affiliate's over. We got to move into search.
Wait, was this like a Jack Ma moment where you had to like rally your troops and tell them we're going in a new direction or?
I had to convince my Chinese partner, who now he thought it was a little nutty beforehand. Now he thought it was full out crazy because I'd spent so long convincing him about the future of affiliate. And I came back from the search conference and it was just boiler room sales guys. They didn't know anything about data.
Wow.
And I knew from Google that the data in search was way more valuable than any other marketplace. And so I'm like, we're going to be way ahead of the game on this. We need, as soon as we finish building the affiliate, we'll use that to fund building into search. And it's lucky we did, because affiliate just never went anywhere. It got up to this point and then Alibaba just crushed the market.
You know, they took all, really competitive.
Well, I mean, they just took all they took all the profit out. Basically, if they're only going to give 5%, they're only going to take 5% for themselves. That was my 5%. That was my 15%, you know, and it was suddenly gone, right? Because they had all the offer. You know, if you want to sell, you have to have the offer. They had the offer and they wouldn't put it on the third parties anymore. So all the affiliates just went directly at Alibaba. Now, we started doing search in like late 2006. So we had had the platform, the affiliate platform up in middle 2006. So we were really early. We were beta API partner for Baidu. And an API beta from Baidu at that point was incredibly bad. Completely worthless. You know, we were just saying,
early.
We were basically their outsourced QA team. Yeah, that's broken. Yeah, that's broken too. Actually, none of this shit works. Just why don't you give us version two? And in the meantime, we're just going to keep.
You know what?
We're just going to keep working without the API. Like you said, it was like it was a formative time. None of these companies were that big. Neither Ali, Baidu, or Tencent were that big. You know, they weren't like the behemoths that they are today. And everybody was just trying to figure stuff out. So there was a lot of opportunity, but there was also like a lot of stuff that was just breaking all over the place. And I was trying to do this in another language, in another culture.
Oh my God.
And you know, and I was just making all kinds of mistakes, basically.
What about your partner? Your partner was local or foreign?
He was local.
He was local. How important is that?
I mean, look, I will say this, you know, even though, and I'll say this up front, even though in the end it didn't work out, you know, between us as partners, I wouldn't have been able to do it on my own. It was too far removed at this point.
And
in
what
time,
year? What year time frame are we talking about, though?
2005 is when I recruited him.
And
then he worked with me until, so basically in, I think we agreed to the partnership around September, October, 2005. Mm-hmm. And then until March of 2010. Right. So about 4.5 years.
Okay. I'm just thinking, you know, for our listeners, which are mostly outside China now, you couldn't have done it without him then.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you could do it without a local partner today?
Hmm. Good question.
I would say you can to a point. But I honestly, I think, you know, and you can hire great staff, but they're really hard to find. Uh-huh. Right. So I don't recommend doing any business by yourself, period.
I'm going to get you on that. I'm coming right after that.
Right.
But finish this first.
Right. But I still believe in China. It's there's things that you are fit to do and you bring so much value as an outsider to the market because you have different experience and different perspective that you can bring. However, there are still things here that operate in a way that they've been operating for thousands of years.
Wow.
And you're just not going to be very good at them.
Yeah.
Right. You know, for example, working with Chinese local media companies, it's not very simple and straightforward
or transparent.
Right. It's a very opaque, relationship driven, I would say, you know, business.
Read between the lines.
Right. They need to be able to trust you explicitly, which in all honesty, you know, no matter how good your Chinese is and now no matter how long you've been here, you're not Chinese and they're never going to 100% trust you. Yep. So it's very difficult to do business with some of those companies if they don't trust you explicitly. Yep. It just gets very, very, very hard to operate. So in those cases, when you have somebody who's really good at that, and I did have a person like that for 2 to 3 years, it's like suddenly all my work with the Chinese media companies got so much easier, right? And smooth, and the business just ran.
Yeah.
Those were our going years, right? Those 3 years from like around 2000, I would say 8.5, 9 to like 2011, like our business exploded. And part of the reason was I wasn't always trying to overcome these obstacles that I just didn't know how to get around. I had somebody who was really good at that. Great operator, bilingual, and the media guys loved him, right? And that's the, I mean, if you can find that person, it's huge. Yeah. And I just don't think you can really do it in this particular industry. Really hard to do it without.
And I think, you know, don't take it personally. I think when you do have all these troubles, because it's not them just not trusting you. This is just eons of no trust of anybody.
Opium wars.
That's just the way it is. But people have trusted in the past, and those people that they trusted have stolen their companies. So there's just zero trust anymore.
True.
You know? And I think when we talked with Jared from Sinisroll in a couple podcasts ago, you know, he had adopted that amazing attitude of just being very
persistent as well.
Yeah, and forgiving, and just playing the game as long as it took, whatever, just happy to be above ground and just playing the game.
There you go.
Now, you know, again, before we go to break, I just wanted to ask a little bit more about, because you've talked before at events and publicly about the importance of stakeholders and stakeholder management. You know, you have the partner, you have your Chinese partner. Was it just one?
Just one.
So how did you manage that? And then I guess capstone that with overall managing stakeholders when you're doing a startup.
The first stakeholder is I call it the hidden co-founder, you know, your significant other, you know, in life, whoever that may be, because in any startup, you're basically running forward, breaking shit and trying to piece shit back together so you can make it to the next day. And that's a lot of battling. The last thing you want to do is to come home and continue battling.
Yeah.
Some people have the energy for that, but I was in my early 30s, mid 30s when I was doing this. I didn't have the energy for that.
No.
You know, I had the energy in the startup. I was willing to work hard. I was willing to work weekends. I was willing to push the envelope. But when I got home had to be a haven. Mm-hmm. So I really believe if you don't have that person 110% committed, you know, to X number of years of like pursuing this, there's exceptions.
Yeah.
But I can't. I would not be able to be successful without that. So that was first and foremost. The Chinese partner, I would say I did everything I could possibly do to find somebody who I thought would be the right person, including getting, you know, recommendations from somebody who was the GM of Taiwan for eBay, the CFO for EachNet, which eBay acquired in China, right? And even like the head of strategy for North Asia for eBay. They all vouched for this guy, right? They all said, this guy will not screw you. You can trust him. Okay. And the second thing was, and he didn't, right? And the second thing was, he was working in business information. So he's working with data, which is something that very few people at that time really had any appreciation of.
Yeah, totally.
So I felt like for what I wanted to try to do as a business, and I had all this background, you know, positive, you know, you can trust him.
Yeah.
That was the best I could do.
Sure.
But the one thing that he did not have prior was management experience of staff. And he was supposed to be like the COO, because obviously from a communication standpoint, that would be harder for me. And he was, you know, managing the HR, and I was doing like finance, new biz, development, blah, 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 building some of the products and services that we had. And it was good, you know, separation stuff, but that became the challenge in the future, was that as the business grew, he needed to manage more people. That became a struggle. And it was mostly just because he had a communication style that was very, very different. It was very, very local, traditional style. I'm the boss. You listen to what I say. And our business doesn't really run very well on that, because whatever knowledge that we have in our heads, it decays like super fast because the market keeps moving. And so what worked 6 months ago absolutely is not going to work today. And if you're thinking that way, you're screwed, right? So you really have to be very good about pulling the information bottom up from the staff and telling you, well, what's happening on the front lines?
Yeah.
You know, what's happening with the campaigns? What's happening with the client? What's happening in the market? Because you guys are in it. You know, I'm just listening to it, and then I have to help you make a decision. That's not his style, right? He was a very command control type of person. So that became a challenge.
Okay. All right. So thank you very much. I'm not going to completely let that go just yet. But when we come back from the break, we will go into how you then separated, I think, as partners, and your experience through that of actually the breakup and what it's like to break up with a foreign versus local. And then, of course, we want to continue the tour of how things went after that happened. And then, I guess, talk about the exit. So we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. We want to give a shout out to our sponsors. China Accelerator is the number one accelerator in the East. They are a mentorship-driven program that takes your ideas from all over the world and helps you make them successful in China. At the same time, we take great ideas from inside China and help them grow all over the world. If you want to find out more, please visit www.chinaaccelerator.com, and batch 10 applications are going to be open soon, so it's a really good opportunity to get in there.
We also want to thank our other sponsor, PeopleSquared. PeopleSquared is the largest and best co-working space across China. They've got 8 or 9 spaces in Shanghai. They've got spaces up in Beijing. They've got spaces down in Shenzhen. They really are the best community of people to be dealing with here. So if you have a startup and you're coming to China, PeopleSquared is your number one choice.
And we'd also like to thank our syndication partner, Technode. They are the number one source for news and information about the startup ecosystem, what's going on inside of China. They also work with TechCrunch and helped publish and syndicate that. So we're really happy to have them on as a syndication partner. You can find out more at technode.com.
Okay, we're back from our break. We are all hydrated and renewed. So I want to keep talking about, you know, so you split with the co-founder. How'd that go? What happened? What was that experience like?
Yeah, how do you do it without bloodshed?
Yes.
Okay, so...
Was there bloodshed? We don't even know. Yeah. You're assuming there wasn't, but there might have been.
So I would say, well, look, he said when the word, you know, we had a board meeting, and the board kind of laid it out and said, look, we're going to remove you from your operating role, right? You're going to retain your shares and everything else, but that's it. And he's like, yeah, I knew this was coming. And I think, you know, he knew instinctively that we were not obviously communicating very well, and that I was really struggling, because generally the people who refused to report to him ended up all reporting to me.
Yeah.
And by reporting,
you mean complaining?
Well, it began with complaining, and then they refused to report to him. And so basically they reported to me. You know, it was like one point the CTO is like, I'm not going to work with Charles anymore. So I'm either I work with you or I quit. And I'm like, yeah, it's pretty hard to run a technology business without the CTO. So Charles, we're not going to let him quit, and he's going to report to me now. I made every effort to try to help him, even going so far as to like have a 360-degree review by an outside company do that to try to help him understand. I'm like, I just don't think you see yourself the way other people see you. Mm-hmm. Right? It's one of those things where they draw the attributes. And you do yourself, and it comes out like a circle, and then you do everybody else, right? And if your circle is really big and the people's circle of you is really small, then you got a problem.
Mm-hmm. I believe they call that the Johari window.
Yeah, whatever it's called, that's what he had. And I think he, you know, to his credit,
to his credit,
later years, like 2 or 3 years afterwards, he actually went back to certain senior staff and almost like, you know, like an addict going back and apologizing, you know, to different people. And he did reach out to me, and I'm like, dude, scars. I just don't want to reopen them. I'm like, I appreciate the gesture, but I've already put it behind me. And, you know, so I will say this, you're best to prepare how you're going to divide when you start. Mm-hmm. Not when you get to the point of no return. We didn't do that, obviously. And so, you know, what ended up being negotiated was like a 2-year severance at full salary. Plus, he got to keep all of his shares. This was very generous. Mm-hmm. And it was basically because I was barely keeping the shop open as we were at that point experiencing like massive cash flow problems. Just unbelievably bad problems. And I told the board, I'm like, I cannot fight a war on multiple fronts.
Yeah.
I'm like, I just can't, you know, I agree it's expensive. It seems too much, but if I don't put my full energy on this other thing, it won't matter. I'm like, I think it's too much, but literally just give it to them. And then maybe we have a chance. I felt like if we, you know, if we kept stringing that out, he was going to do something radical. Mm-hmm. Right. He was going to like literally like try to harm the business. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't very veiled about it.
Yeah.
He was very direct about it. And so it was tough. And that's why it's like, you know, not like you need a prenuptial, but you sort of need something in the beginning to say, if we part ways, how are we going to part?
Yeah.
So we don't have to figure it out under duress.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Ray. Is the fact that there is such an overemphasis on face and reputation and the fact that nobody should ever know that you ever failed at anything. Did this at all play into how he was acting or reacting to the situation, do you think? I mean, do you think he was so vigilante about this and asked for far too much and things because he felt that this was going to be very damning to him?
In all honesty, we were in that, what'd you call it again? The Kahari?
The Johari window.
The Johari window.
It's, it's a, like, right. This is the way I see myself. This is the way I think other people see me. And then this is how people actually see me.
So it's hard to decouple the Johari window from, you know, the general Chinese culture, because the Johari window in this case was so pronounced.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure that plays a role for everybody in this situation, regardless of culture or background.
Yeah,
you know, nobody
anywhere
wants to, you know, like there's plenty of founders going on who've talked about getting fired, you know, by their investors. I wasn't in the best place to sort of deal with it. But like, and it got to the point, he's like, you know, you can't fire me. And I'm like, you know, Charles, Steve Jobs got fired. You can get fired too.
Yeah,
right. You know, there's a difference. There's a difference between once you take outside money, right? It's not your company anymore.
Yeah.
Right. You may be running it. You may have the most shares in it, but you're not independently making these decisions anymore. And being a founder does not necessitate that you will always be in an operating role.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. Right. And I think that was the part that he struggled with, because his self-identity was so tied up with the company, as was mine. And so this was kind of being ripped away from him, and he didn't like that. And,
yeah, of course.
And I wouldn't have liked it if I'd been on the other side. I would have been upset about it.
I think we can all kind of relate to that.
Yeah.
True. True enough. Okay. Life after that.
So life after that. So like I said, at that point in time, even though we raised first an angel round, which was done under some duress, because we had an affiliate company from Japan who'd agreed to put in $1 million USD. And with a month, you know, that we were closing, three material terms in the deal were being renegotiated. Mm. We had had an angel come in who wanted to participate. And so I said, I'd like to bring in this angel, pass off some of the risk on you guys. We'll bring him in at 250K. You guys will come in at 750. And when these guys really started to mess with me, my angel investor became a true angel in that he agreed to go to five. So I didn't have to take money from mm-hmm. the Japanese guys. That was unfortunate. I actually remained friends with all of the deal guys, even mm-hmm. though I basically booted their company, you know, out of, you know, my initial angel round. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, so we had that and that, you know, we were close to running out of money
yeah.
at that point. Like my partner and I each put in 100K US, right? And we'd been running the business for a little like two and a half years, super lean.
Yeah, but I mean, you always have a few months.
Right. You're always coming down to that. And then next year we were raising money. We had Intel give us a term sheet and then the background check of my partner came up bad. So they dropped it. And I was like, oh, that's rough. And I was really looking at this going, I'm not going to give up on this guy just because of that. We've come too far and he's put in a lot to get to this point. So then, you know, we were able to successfully raise right before the financial crisis.
Ooh.
I mean, August 2008.
Oh, ouch.
That's, like, that's literally
right there.
Yeah, we literally closed like right before the window just came crashing down. And but within 12 months of that, all of my working capital was tied up in media buys, primarily on Baidu, because Baidu was not giving a whole lot of payment terms. And my clients were all multinationals for the most part, who were paying me in 60 to 90 days. So we were negative 30 to 60 days. And some clients like China Mobile spent like a year and a half at one point before we got money. So this is killing us. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely killing us. And in some cases we had a media agency in the middle. So they were collecting money from the clients, then adding down their own 30 or 60 days. We were really backwards. And this was one of the struggles that we had was that, you know, my partner was like, all I need to do is get profitable and then everything will be fixed. And I'm like, no, that's not going to fix it. In fact, we almost have to slow down the growth of the business because if we continue to grow now, we're going to grow right out of business. And that became a huge, you know.
That's a crazy thing to think about.
Right. It became a huge problem because it just doesn't make sense to the layman.
Take on more risk.
Right. But basically, it's like the faster we grew, the bigger the cash flow problem got.
Yeah. Wow.
Right.
Yeah,
so this was something that he had never experienced that before. And if I hadn't gone to business school, I wouldn't have understood that at all. Right. But I was seeing that. I'm like, no, actually, we don't need any more sales. In fact, we need to like lose some of these clients. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Who are really bad in the cash flow. And we need to find ways to offset. So, you know, the biggest challenge I faced post partner was that, you know, one, I had a really good guy who was managing my media relationships. I brought in, and I just said, you know, you run that. And he was awesome. But the other thing was like, I had to basically restructure the business. So we got away or reduced our exposure to this media buy and started working on stuff that was like cash flow positive, just like pure consulting, like SEO stuff and social media stuff. And so our business in like 2010, when he like exited, was probably around 80% paid media related, like paid search related. And by 2015, it was only about 50%.
Wow.
You know,
so a big change happened.
Yeah. So it was gradual because we had to layer in, like I had to build my SEO business and not focus on building my paid search business. And then I had to build a social media business.
Yep.
Right. And do these different things. But because that doesn't take up as much capital, working capital, right, I could start to balance these things out. But, you know, the other thing was there was a period also we had to go into gray markets and borrow money.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Wow. Ugly.
This seems like you guys had a lot of moments where you're just trying to pull everything together. I got to imagine that you guys were thinking about an exit from the very beginning. Did you have to remind yourselves and everyone around you and, you know, motivate, you know, the exit's going to happen. We're going to do it. Each one of these moments, did you have like a, you know, get everyone to a room or something? And like,
I mean,
how'd you get through and what motivated?
Yeah. The original premise was, you know, with an affiliate business that we would go public because there were publicly traded companies in Japan and Korea, let alone Europe and US. Now, once that business started to go sideways, if you look at the search engine business, there hadn't been a whole lot of publicly traded companies in the space. Mm-hmm. Like Efficient Frontier when we were starting was the big one. They got acquired, but it wasn't a good acquisition. right? Marin Software is the most recent one to go public, but there's not that many, right? And they were really a software business. So it started to become obvious to me, you know, like around 2011, that the most likely exit was going to be trade sale, right? That we were never going to be, you know, that company, because once we got away from software, it's a service business, then you have a pretty good idea. So the good thing, I would say, was that we had enough of a rep in the market that the holding companies, the WPPs, the Publicis, the Dentsus or whatever, they all came knocking to the door. Wow. Because their model is largely built on acquisition. Largely, right? So they knew who we were. They would come, they would knock, and they say, are you interested? And be like, yeah, maybe now's not a good time. But like around 2011, where we were like just sucking hard on the cash flow, I'm like, yeah, I'm willing to listen now, right? So that was the time when we really started entertaining the offers and started looking at, you know, the way that they value the business, you know, what would be the deal terms, you know, how much would be upfront, how many years of earnout, and all those different, you know, kind of machinations. So I would say on the holding companies right now, I have a pretty good idea on the way that they structure these things.
Did you start tuning the business in order to increase valuation at all? Was that in the back of your mind, or did you just run with your original plan?
I would say the number one thing I had to do was make sure we didn't run out of cash. And so, like, you know, trying to tune the business to get a higher valuation was something I really would like to do after I don't kill myself.
Yeah.
Right. So it was a consideration, but it was never something where I'm like, until the deal is signed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally.
You know, and until the cash flow pressure comes off, it just was never something we could do. I had to figure out just a way to survive.
Yeah.
Right. So the end, I think the most important for me and also for my team from the acquisition process was, you know, I said no a lot. Even though we were desperate for cash, I wasn't willing to just, you know, take whatever offer was on the table, you know, from an investor standpoint, but also from a team standpoint, because if the deal is structured as an earnout, this requires that the people stay in their seats.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. The handcuffs.
If you sign the earnout and it's a people business and all the good people leave, you know, in the first, you know, 6 to 12 months, you're kind of screwed on your earnout.
Yeah.
You're never going to get it, basically. What we did is we focused on optimizing deal terms. Mm-hmm. As opposed to focus on optimizing, you know, the business itself, because the business was really survive, survive, right? And then the deal terms were like, okay, what do these guys have? What do those guys have? How come your terms aren't as good as those guys? You know, working that kind of thing back and forth. But in the end of the day, it really, a lot of it was a cultural fit, right? So, you know, we looked at terms. Some people want it 5 years. I'm like, 5 years in China, are you insane? You realize that our GDP is moving 5x of, like, you know, outside. I'm like, I'm going to have five companies in 5 years. You know, this is way too long. You need to, you know, I talked to these guys and I really liked the deal guy. I know him and other friends have sold, you know, to this holding company. But I said, look, that's not even market. You know, that's not what the other holding companies are like. Well, it's the only way going to make our money back. I'm like, now you're talking to me like a person who doesn't give a shit about the customer. Now you tell me what you need, right? Yeah. Which I have investors. They don't care about your problems, right? They only care about my problems, right? And what they're going to get back. But, you know, basically I just said, look, I really believe that this market does not value the growth enough and that they have standard global terms for a lot of these holding companies. And if the GDP is like 3X or 4X of what it is in these other places, then the earnout should be
bigger.
You know, it should just basically, you know, the timing should be built into that. Yeah. It should be a shorter earnout because the growth is just so much faster, right?
Absolutely.
And the turnover in the market, it's so hard to keep good people here.
Yeah.
It's incredibly hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have some great people who stayed with me for up to like 7-8 years, which is amazing.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Right. It's totally like outside. Like those guys are on the super right hand, you know, of the graph.
Yeah.
They don't even fit. Right, on normal graph terms, because in this industry, in the media, in the digital tech industry, the normal turnover time is like 1.5 to 2 years, right? And it's very hard to build. So anyway.
Okay. Amazing story. That was epic. Have you read Hard Things About Hard Things? Or A Hard Thing About Hard Things?
Love it. Love it.
You just did that in 30 minutes.
Wow.
You know, this
Thank
was,
you.
This, I, this was just...
That's props.
That was just so similar in so many different ways. But hanging on, reinventing. I mean, you didn't pull out different softwares and things like that.
Right.
But Ben Horowitz did. But that's pretty epic. And successful ending. Like, we have a happy ending. Yeah, you got a podcast with a happy ending. This was great. So it's just so highly unusual in China, really, unfortunately. Yeah. Sorry, listeners. But yeah,
it's rare, but it's not impossible.
That's right.
That's
right.
We just proved.
Right. Yeah. And my new partners also successfully exited.
Oh,
wow.
Right.
Nice.
So, you know, two guys in China who found a way to get to an exit.
What's next?
It's all in front of us, man.
Yeah. All right. But in the meantime, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Very, very happy for you. Obviously,
you.
It was a long road. Now you can somewhat celebrate. I'm still waiting to get an invitation to the celebratory party.
Yeah.
At some point, I expect a Dom train to be appearing, some things like this. But anyway, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks
congratulations.
So much.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah. How can we help our guests get a hold of you or basically follow you on Twitter?
They can find me at NetChina on Twitter. I'm not as active. VPNs, you know.
Yeah.
And always LinkedIn. You can always look me up in LinkedIn.
T.R. Harrington.
That's the one.
All right, cool. Anyway, thanks very
Excellent.
Much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ryan, for, you know, rocking that awesome beard. It's been a few episodes since I brought it up, so I thought I'd do it again. But I do it because we were recently in San Francisco, and he bought a very expensive, like a $200 beard trimmer.
Oh, yeah.
It's
tailored.
I just wanted to bring up that it is looking very good again.
It is quite good. Like Twyga.
Yeah. thanks, Vivian, who is behind the glass, even though we have no glass. So she's monitoring every sound and every beep and every cough. Thank you very much for all you do. And thanks to David, who does our post-production. And thank you to you, our listeners. Very much appreciate you guys being there for us week in and week out. That's all for today. Thank you very much, and see you later.